From the KGOU studios, I'm Rebecca Cruz, the Assistant Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Russian writer Elisa Ganeeva's first novel addresses how outside forces have influenced traditional culture, religion, and marriage in her native Dagestan.
Marriage is not about couple decisions of two people, but something that the whole society and the whole community decide.
Ganeeva will talk about her work on today's show. But first, my colleagues Samer Shahata and Gershon Leventhal join me to discuss Trump's announcement this week regarding Jerusalem.
What this does to the perception of the United States, and not just in the Arab world, and not just in the Muslim world, but in the wider world, I think is incredibly damaging.
That's all coming up after the news from NPR. Samer Shahada and Gershon Leventhal, welcome to Worldviews. Well, this week, a very big week in the Middle East and around the world. President Trump came out with an announcement on Wednesday planning to essentially recognize the capital of Jerusalem and move the embassy, the U.S. embassy, to Jerusalem. This has been a city divided in many ways, and there has been kind of an international decision not to recognize Jerusalem, but to wait until a peace process eventually comes. This all changed this week. Gershon, tell us a little bit about what's going on.
So for practical purposes, there is no change. In other words, the embassy isn't suddenly opening in Jerusalem and American citizens.
So there are plans to move it there eventually.
Eventually, in theory. But as Don Shapiro, the former U.S. ambassador, noted in an editorial just this morning, he basically pointed out that if Trump really wanted, there is the facilities to be able to have all those services in Jerusalem right now today. That's not happening. And presumably Trump will continue to defer the move of the embassy for several more years. So this is essentially a rhetorical push on the part of the Trump administration, part of the same kind of things that they've been doing, rejecting the Paris Accords and all these kind of things that sound very impressive to his followers, perhaps in a rhetorical plane. But in terms of actual practicality, don't seem to have too much of an effect.
Okay, Samer, the Arab world feels that this is a bigger issue than just par for the course.
Well, not just the Arab world, the entire world.
Absolutely.
Let's be clear about that. Theresa May made a statement about this. The German foreign minister made a statement about this. The French prime minister made a statement about this. The Pope made a statement about this. So it's not just the Arab world. This was, I think, incredibly disastrous and much more than simply symbolic. It was politically self-interested. Certainly, I think President Trump is playing to part of his base. I think this jeopardizes U.S. national security interests, and many, including people in the administration, have made those kinds of statements. And it also, unfortunately, imperils the prospects of a real resolution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. So it's a disastrous decision.
What have some of the other responses been on the ground? You've talked about some of the official responses from around the world. What are we seeing on the ground?
Well, you know, everyone in the Arab world, including those who are half sincere, have condemned this statement, from Saudi Arabia to the Arab League to those countries and those leaders that actually have existing peace agreements with Israel, King Abdullah of Jordan and the Egyptians and so on. And oftentimes this is seen as, well, what are the consequences? Are there going to be demonstrations and so on? And I think that's at the very best an incomplete way of seeing this, because yes, there will be demonstrations and there will be people who are upset in the current moment. But I think in terms of what this does to the perception of the United States internationally, and not just in the Arab world and not just in the Muslim world, but in the wider world, I think is incredibly damaging. And also for anyone to take seriously the idea that the United States is a neutral broker somehow in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, I think that reveals that lie completely.
Gershon, what is the sense on the ground in Israel? What are we seeing there?
Well, I think across the political spectrum in Israeli society, this is obviously a welcome decision, just for the simple fact that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel from the Israeli perspective. And for all intents and purposes, I think almost every country has recognized the de facto situation, maybe not de jure, but every ambassador makes almost a daily pilgrimage to Jerusalem to meet with Israeli ministers and government officials. They present their credentials to the president in Jerusalem. And so in this respect, that has been going on since Israel's creation. It's basically the capital for 70 years. Whether or not it's a legal recognition, that's a different story. But again, that's more of a rhetorical effect rather than an actual practical impact. And so in Israeli society, they're welcoming this decision, even on the left, because for this is really a consensus issue within Israeli public.
What about Samer's comments that this has beyond the Israeli-Palestinian situation and that this has larger consequences?
Well, I think, and to some degree, many of the critics from within the Arab world who criticize this decision probably did not see the U.S. as an honest broker or neutral broker to begin with. So it's not like this has suddenly revealed something about the United States that wasn't recognized before. I think what it does say is that the United States is recognizing some aspect of the Israeli claims to part of Jerusalem. But as Trump noted, and by no means am I some sort of Trump defender, but to the comments that he read yesterday, he basically said this is not saying these are the decision with respect to the future borders of Jerusalem. And I don't think that any Israeli, especially those of us on the left, are thinking that this means that Jerusalem will never have a place, a role to play for the Palestinian future state. In other words, that Jerusalem could still be determined and divided in the future peace settlements, but there is still a unanimous consensus that Jerusalem should serve as a capital for these two future states, both the Jewish state of Israel and the Palestinian state of Palestine.
Okay, as we wrap up, Samer, go ahead and close us out.
Well, you know, I think I disagree. I mean, there has not been a talk about West Jerusalem being the capital of Israel and East Jerusalem being the capital of a Palestinian state. I mean, that's not what was said, and that's not how it's being received. And that's not what Theresa May and Mr. Macron and Pope Francis and not just the Arab world is criticizing. So I think this is more than a hot button issue for more than a billion Muslims around the world. And so that's why I think it really is a needless self-inflicted blow to the United States and to this administration, unfortunately, with consequences for people, particularly Palestinians, on the ground.
Well, we will no doubt continue to watch this. Thank you both for your perspectives. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this discussion or answer any questions you might have. Leave your comments in the Worldview section of KGOU.org or like us, follow us, and interact with us on Twitter. We're at WorldviewsKGOU. Next, we'll hear from author Alisa Ganeva about the Russian Republic of Dagestan and how she uses fiction to approach cultural change. I'm Rebecca Cruz, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Rebecca Cruz, the Assistant Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Alisa Ganeva is an author from the Russian Republic of Dagestan. She won the debut literary prize for young Russian language writers in 2009 using a male pseudonym. She's also the author of The Mountain and the Wall and The Bride and the Bridegroom. All of her novels are based in Dagestan. Alisa Ganeva, welcome to Worldviews.
Hello.
So you are a poet and a writer, and you are from a part of the world that perhaps people here in the United States don't know all that much about. So I thought perhaps we could start with you telling us a little bit about Dagestan, which is in the Caucasus region near Russia, depending on how you categorize things. But could you tell us a little bit about your home country?
Yes, thank you. Dagestan, the name of this tiny republic on the very southern tip of Russia can be translated as the country of mountains because it's really in this mountainous region of Caucasus. And it became a part of Russia in the middle of the 19th century, rather long ago. But since that, it's still remaining a hotspot of the country. It's Muslim populated, lots of ethnic minorities live there, each speaking its own language. For example, I do belong to one of these minorities called Avar people. It's the major ethnicity in Dagestan. So my mother tongue is Avarian language. But I grew up in Russian culture and I started writing in Russian and I write in Russian language, but I use this peculiar pidgin Russian spoken in my native region when people just mix words and expressions and use some syntaxes or some grammar or some phraseology from their own local languages. And I came to Moscow to study in the Literary Institute of after my high school when I was 17. And I was really surprised when I encountered people who didn't know that I'm from Russia as well, because the country is so big and it's populated by such a diverse population that people living in the capital, in Moscow, and all life in Russia is centralized. All the cultural events, all the major things are happening just in two cities of Moscow or St. Petersburg. And that is why people who grow up in Moscow, they have somewhat snobbish relationship with the rest of Russia, and sometimes they do not realize the boundaries of their own country. So they kept asking me, what currency do you have?
Oh, no.
Where did you learn to speak Russian, and so on. And so I started writing about this region, which is so unknown and also full of stereotypes, because during the 90s there was a war for independence going on in the neighboring republic called Chechnya. Maybe you heard something about that. And then during last 15 or 20 years, we're having the rise of Islamic fundamentalism, something which is happening in different parts of the world nowadays. So it's the same thing in my native region, when different branches of Islam fight together, when the more traditional Sufi and philosophical branch is coming into conflict with the more fundamentalist so-called Salafi movement of Islam. And it also goes along with the dissatisfaction of especially young people with the system they're living in, with the police lawlessness, with corruption. And so they're trying to find some stable structure where the law is actually working. And when missionaries from the Middle East come and convert them into this fundamentalist version of Islam, they make these young people to believe that the Sharia independent state would be a solution and would be this paradise on earth. So in my first novel, which has been translated into English, which came out 2 years ago under the title of The Mountain and the Wall, I'm trying to show what can happen if this region is separated from Russia by the wall. So the topic of walls, of separation, is really becoming of a current interest.
Absolutely.
In USA as well.
Yes.
And so I was really excited when it was translated by Carol Apollonia, who is a Duke University professor, and it came out in a little publishing house in Texas. So my next novel is coming out in 2 months, and it is called Bride and Groom, and it is dedicated to the matrimonial institution in this closed society. And
how is that different than we might think of matrimony elsewhere? Is there something unique to it, unique to your culture and marriage?
Yes, it's a hodgepodge of different traditions. When archaic attitude towards marriage, when marriage is not about couple decisions of two people, but something that the whole society and the whole community decide, and it's all about collective matchmaking. When parents make a list of potential brides and show it to their son, and the son has to pick up. And so the plot, my story, my novel begins with the family, the parents booking a big banquet hall. Like 3 or 4 months ahead, and they spend lots of money for it. So the hall is booked, but the bride is not yet chosen. So
wow.
We have a date of the wedding, but my main character has to find his bride. And it may seem too melodramatic, too fantastical and unreal, but in fact that's the way our things happen there. At the same time, the globalization is working, and everybody is on social networks and online, and so
that plays a role in this matchmaking as well, social media.
Yes, it's really so the traditional society is erased by these new tendencies and trends, but at the same time, their authentic culture is dissolved, and people living in these regions, they do not really understand who they are now, and they something that they think to be their own tradition and their own history is in fact something enforced on them. For example, many traditions that people of my age are enjoying, wearing hijabs, for example, and so on, is not something authentical or very traditional for this region, because Islam was a very superficial thing for the region. And for example, some of grandmothers and grannies and older women, they are smelling tobacco, they are wearing tattoos, and they are very used to the role of the head of a family. So it doesn't resemble anything what we think about a Muslim woman or a woman from Saudi Arabia, for example. So it's all about fashion, and it's all about abrasion of the true historical memory and substituting real forefathers by some artificial forefathers. And it's a big problem which I'm trying to tackle in the form of fiction. So I just tell stories. I tell how people meet, how they fight, how they wed, how they die, and how they argue. And I love dialogue, a dialogue.
I find it fascinating that you say that the people in Russia, in Moscow in particular, didn't understand that you too were Russian, and that there were issues there, and they had stereotypes about Dagestan. What are, I don't know, the top three things that you would want our listeners to understand about your country? What stereotypes can we get away from?
There is this perception that Caucasus, and especially Muslim-populated region, that it's very conservative and maybe aggressive to everything that doesn't fit the frame. But in fact, if you trace the history back, you can see that the region really hosted maybe primitive but still very democratic institutions. For example, my grand-grandparents further on, my ancestors lived in so-called free alliances, where the head of the alliance or the union of villages was elected each 4 years when there was a union of villagers or towners. So they collected together, they made decisions. And also talking about the women's place in the society, the land, which was the most precious and valuable thing in mountains, where there is just few of land which is suitable for agriculture, it was inherited only by daughters. So it was passed from mother to daughter. And our sons got houses and buildings, and our daughters got the land, which was the main property. And also it's a region of craftsmen which still survive through centuries. There are villages of silversmiths and pottery makers and carpet makers which do not use any chemical materials or anything very modern, and do stick to and adhere to very ancient and old craft traditions, which is quite a unique place. And also so many nationalities and languages on a little spot spot of land. It's also quite unusual.
Very multicultural, and the image of the mountains, and it sounds lovely. You mentioned gender, and one thing I think is interesting is you did have a published work that you published under a pseudonym, a male pseudonym, and from what I understand, you received an award for this piece, and it wasn't until you went up to accept the award that those that were granting it realized that you were in fact a woman. That must have been fun, being able to kind of say the joke is on you. But what was your motivation in doing this, and why did you decide to see it through until the ceremony?
That was the very, very beginning of my creative career. Mm-hmm. So it was my first long story I've ever written. And when I finished it, I realized that it's a very masculine world. And while writing it, I really felt as if I'm somebody else, and as if I'm some young man from the same region. And also when I decided to submit this piece of fiction for a very vibrant competition, or for young writers under 25 years. It's a competition for which around 70,000 manuscripts are applied every year. So it's very competitive. And And I was already being published as a critic, so I didn't want to be recognized, and I wanted to get a very clear and neutral assessment. So I got this pseudonym. I submitted my manuscript. I went through this vetting process, and then there was a long list and then short list, and then people started talking about this boy and the manuscript and trying to find him, and then I had to register fake email and messenger and to give interviews, and then they asked me to send a picture, a portrait of a boy, and that was another challenge. I was looking for a picture. And finally, five finalists remained. And during the awarding ceremony, when I had to step up the stage and receive the award, everybody knew that it was me. But it was a fine experiment, not just a literary hoax, because it also raised the discussion about the problem of gender in literature.
Absolutely.
Is there such a thing as a feminine prose or masculine prose, and how can you tell apart one from another? And I remember one of the jury members who started, once he knew who was the real author, he started to reread my long story in order to find the traces of the woman's pen, of the woman's word and voice. And I found one episode when I'm describing a wedding in Dagestan, and the dancers, the guests on the wedding, they are passing a special stick for dancers, adorned, embellished stick covered in material. In a textile, in a special textile. So I put a name of this textile, and I said no man would mention the name of this. So these petty details is something that women do.
Oh, how interesting, and absolutely an interesting experience and experiment to see how people reacted, and how fascinating that he went back and reviewed it for that. Well, it sounds like you're doing just a wonderful work portraying your country, your people, and hopefully we can learn more and more about that from you. So congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to my conversation with Elisa Ganeva. She's an award-winning author from the Russian Republic of Dagestan. Worldviews is produced in partnership between KGOU and the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Katie Holland prepares our research, Jacob McClellan edited this interview, and Sam Dupre produced this show. For Gershon Leventhal and Samer Shahata, I'm Rebecca Cruz.